The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on February 8th, entitled, Poll, a third of Americans are Christian nationalists, and most are white evangelicals, by Yonat Shimron. A new survey finds that fewer than a third of Americans, or 29%, qualify as Christian nationalist, and of those, two-thirds define themselves as white evangelicals. The survey of 6,212 Americans by the Public Religion Research Institute and the Brookings Institution is the largest yet to gauge the size and scope of Christian nationalist beliefs. It finds that 10% of Americans are avowed Christian nationalists, what the survey called adherents, while an additional 19% are sympathetic to Christian nationalist ideals. Among white evangelical Protestants, nearly two-thirds are either white Christian nationalism adherents or sympathizers. Support for Christian nationalism is significantly smaller among Asian American, mixed race, Black, and Hispanic Protestants. Majorities of white mainline Protestants, Catholics, Jews, members of other non-Christian faiths, and unaffiliated Americans, on the other hand, reject or mostly reject Christian nationalism. The survey calls them skeptics and rejectors. Attention to Christian nationalism has grown rapidly in the past few years, especially in the wake of the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The term describes a religious and political belief system that argues the United States was founded by God to be a Christian nation. In the survey, supporters of Christian nationalism were identified by their responses to five statements, including, the U.S. should be declared a Christian nation, and God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all areas of American society. They were then assigned a place on a Christian nationalism scale. Unlike other studies that have suggested Christian nationalists are only nominally church-going, the PRRI Brookings survey found Christian nationalists are significantly more likely than other Americans to be connected to churches and to say religion is important in their lives. There's a strong positive correlation between frequency of church attendance and likelihood of being a Christian nationalism adherent or sympathizer, said Robert P. Jones, president and founder of PRRI. Christian nationalism adherents are more than six times as likely as Christian nationalism rejectors to attend church weekly. Avowed Christian nationalists also tend to be older, with about 6 in 10 Christian nationalists and their sympathizers over the age of 50. They are also less educated than other Americans. Only 18% of Christian nationalism supporters have a four-year college degree, compared with 36% of those who were labeled skeptics and 48% of Christian nationalism rejectors. Christian nationalism as a worldview is not new, but the term is. Indeed, a third of respondents said they had not heard of the term. For that reason, it's impossible to say whether the ranks of Christian nationalists have grown over time. In their book, Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, sociologist Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry found that about 20% of Americans strongly embrace Christian nationalist ideas. The PRRI survey is more in line with the 2021 Pew Research Survey that found that 10% of Americans are what Pew identified as hardcore faith and flag conservatives. Whatever the precise number, the survey confirms that by a ratio of 2 to 1, Americans reject a Christian nationalist worldview. The vast majority of Americans, 70%, do not think the government should declare America a Christian nation. and nearly 60% do not think its laws should be based on Christian values. Most Americans, 73%, said they preferred a country made up of a diversity of faiths and not just Christianity. Still, Christian nationalists have an outsized influence in American politics. More than half of Republicans now identify as Christian nationalists or sympathizers, the survey concludes. Some members of Congress, notably Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, proudly endorsed the label. Former President Donald Trump called himself a nationalist, and the survey finds Christian nationalists have far more favorable views of Trump than the general population. That makes the political power of Christian nationalists far greater than their actual numbers in the population. If we were in Europe and had four or five political parties, we'd have a Christian nationalist party, and it would represent a quarter of the country, or 30% at most, said Jones. But because we have this binary system, that group loads into one political party. That's why the country feels divided. Christian nationalist influence is also felt theologically. Two-thirds of Christian nationalists believe that biblical obligations to the poor are more about charitable acts by individuals rather than the task of a just society. Americans as a whole are divided. 54% say biblical injunctions to care for the poor are about charitable acts by individuals, compared with 47% who believe they are primarily talking about our obligation to create a just society. Those who identify as Christian nationalists overwhelmingly trust far-right news outlets such as One American News Network, Newsmax, or Fox to deliver their news. On issues such as race, immigration, and Islam, their views diverge significantly from that of most Americans. 4 in 10 Americans, or 41%, agreed that discrimination against white Americans is as big of a problem as discrimination against black Americans. But among avowed Christian nationalists, 85%, and sympathizers, 73%, who are white, overwhelming numbers agree that discrimination against whites is as big a problem as discrimination against blacks. About a third of Americans affirm the core tenet of so-called Great Replacement Theory, the belief that immigrants are invading our country and replacing our cultural and ethnic background. But 71% of avowed Christian nationalists and 57% of Christian national sympathizers agree the replacement theory is taking place. Fewer than 4 in 10 Americans, or 39%, believe that the values of Islam are at odds with American values and the American way of life. But a majority of Christian nationalists say the Muslim faith is at odds with the American way of life, between 58% and 69%. Not all Christian nationalists are white, the survey found, but white Christian nationalists hold consistent views on race, immigration, and Islam. Speaking to the results of a survey at a Brookings Institution forum, Jamar Tisby, a historian and author of The Color of Compromise and How to Fight Racism, concluded, "White Christian nationalism is the greatest threat to democracy and the witness of the church in the United States today." The survey was conducted online between November and December 2022. It had a margin of error of plus or minus 1.6 percentage points. Now, an article from the Associated Press that was published in the Religion News Service on the 6th of February and written by Michael Casey, entitled "Psychedelic Churches in U.S. Pushing Boundaries of Religion," Hilldale, Utah. The tea tasted bitter and earthy, but Lorenzo Gonzalez drank it anyway. On that night in remote Utah, he was hoping for a life-changing experience, which is how he found himself inside a tent with 24 others waiting for the psychedelic brew known as ayahuasca to kick in. Soon, the gentle sounds of a guitar were drowned out by people vomiting, a common downside of the drug. Gonzalez started howling, sobbing, laughing, and repeatedly babbling. Facilitators from Hummingbird Church placed him face down, calming him momentarily before he started laughing again and crawling. I've seen these dark veins come up in this big red light, and then I've seen this image of the devil, Gonzalez said later. He had quieted only when his wife, Flor, touched his shoulder and prayed. His journey to this town along the Arizona-Utah border is part of a growing global trend of people turning to ayahuasca to treat an array of health problems after conventional medications and therapy failed. Their problems include eating disorders, depression, substance use disorders, and PTSD. The rising demand for ayahuasca has led to hundreds of churches, like this one, which advocates say are protected from prosecution by a 2006 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. In that case, a New Mexico branch of a Brazilian-based ayahuasca church won the right to use the drug as a sacrament, even though its active ingredient remains illegal under U.S. federal law. A subsequent lower court decision ruled Oregon branches of a different ayahuasca church could use it. In every major city in the U.S., every weekend, there's multiple ayahuasca ceremonies, said Sean McAllister, who represents an Arizona church in a lawsuit against the federal government after its ayahuasca from Peru was seized at the Port of Los Angeles. The pro-psychedelics movement's growth has sparked concerns of a government crackdown. In addition to ayahuasca shipments being seized, some churches stopped operating over fears of prosecution. There are also concerns these unregulated ceremonies might pose a danger for some participants and that the benefits of ayahuasca haven't been well studied. It was dark as the hummingbird ceremony began on a Friday night in October, except for flickering candles and the orange glow of heaters. Psychedelic art hung from the walls. Statues of the Virgin Mary and Mother Earth were positioned near a makeshift altar. Participants sat in silence, waiting for Teta Pedro de Vila, the Colombian shaman and traditional healer, who oversaw the ceremony. A mix of military veterans, corporate executives, thrill seekers, ex-members of a polygamous sect, and a man who struck it rich on a game show had turned up for the $900 weekend. Many appeared apprehensive, yet giddy, to begin the first of three ceremonies. The brew contains an Amazon rainforest shrub with the active ingredient N, or DMT, and a vine containing alkaloids that prevents the drug from breaking down in the body. Those who drink ayahuasca report seeing shapes and colors and going on wild, sometimes terrifying journeys that can last hours. In this dreamlike state, some say they encounter dead relatives, friends, and spirits. You are invited for a weekend of healing, Davila told the group before people lined up for their tea. Locking eyes with each participant, Davila uttered a prayer over the cups before blowing on them with a whistling sound and handing them over to drink. Gonzalez and his wife, Flor, were among the ayahuasca newcomers. They had driven from California, hoping for relief for 50-year-old Gonzalez. He'd battled drug addiction for much of his life, was suffering the effects of COVID-19, and had been diagnosed with early-stage dementia. My poor body is dying, and I don't want it to die, said Gonzalez, who rarely sleeps and is prone to fits of anger. Maylene Jessup was also a newcomer, but grew up in Hilldale, the Utah town where the ceremony was held. She is a former member of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, a polygamous offshoot of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Hilldale was the group's stronghold. The ceremony was held in a tent on the grounds of a house once owned by a former FLDS member. Jessup, 35, left the church after its leader, Warren Jeffs, was arrested for sexually assaulting girls he considered brides. He is serving a life sentence in federal prison. Jessup has struggled to adapt to her new life, battling depression and haunted by the physical and sexual abuse she endured as a child. The roots of ayahuasca go back hundreds of years to ceremonial use by indigenous groups in the Amazon. In the past century, churches have emerged in several South American countries where ayahuasca is legal. The movement found a foothold in the U.S. in the 1980s, and interest has intensified more recently as celebrities like NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers and Hollywood actor Will Smith talked about attending ceremonies. Some spend thousands of dollars to attend five-star ayahuasca retreats in the Amazon. But in the U.S., the movement remains largely underground, promoted by social media and word of mouth, with ceremonies held in supporters' homes, Airbnb rentals, and remote areas to avoid law enforcement scrutiny. Like many of these, Hummingbird won't be mistaken for a traditional Western church. It has no written text and relies primarily on Davila's prayers, chants, and songs to guide participants through the ceremony. Davila follows traditions learned from his grandfather. Courtney Close, Hummingbird's founder, who credits ayahuasca with helping her overcome cocaine addiction and postpartum depression, believes the designation as a church helps show that participants are doing this for religious reasons. But when it comes to defining it as a religion, Close stressed that depends on individual participants' experience. We just try to create a spiritual experience without any dogma and just let people experience God for themselves, she said. Back in California, Flora Gonzalez is convinced ayahuasca is behind her husband's improvement. I just feel like we have a future, she said. Now, an article that was published on the 8th of February in the Religion News Service, written by Candace Marie Benbow, Who Will Lead the Spiritual Awakening for Black Men? Over the Christmas holiday, I had a troubling conversation with a younger sister about her relationships with black men. She told me she was finding it increasingly difficult to stomach even the sight or presence of them. She'd stopped dating altogether and put distance between herself and men in her family. When she asked me, "How can you stand them?" I took a moment and then told her the truth. For all of the ways black men have disappointed me, I have never conceived of my world without them, and I didn't want to. That doesn't mean I haven't watched with horror the rising venom that gets spewed at black women. It's impossible to scroll social media without seeing many black male content creators making black women the butt of their jokes, or vilifying them for simply breathing. On podcasts or social media streams of consciousness, black men have made it known that the modern black woman, a woman who advocates for herself and agency, is not to be trusted and will continue to be the downfall of our people. Watching younger black boys get sucked into the black manosphere can lead to its own depressive episode. I've read too often about the murders of young black girls and women at the hands of black boys and men. The reality that a black woman is three times more likely than other women to be killed by her partner is hard to shake. Let's not forget how droves of black men lost their collective minds last year defending rapper Tory Lanez as he stood trial for shooting hip-hop megastar Megan Thee Stallion. Despite the mountain of evidence against him, men, including some we know personally, taunted Megan, even as scores of black women came forward with their own stories of sexual assault and gender-based violence. When a Los Angeles jury found him guilty on all charges, many dismissed the verdict as the system swallowing yet another black man. And while there were black men who stood and stand in solidarity with us in the worst moments, it is impossible to ignore those who are silent. All of this points to a very serious issue, a lack of spirituality among Black men. It is impossible to be rooted in faith or religious identity and not care about the harm you project into the world. A Pew Research study found that even though Black men are more religious than white people, they trail Black women in religiosity. As Black millennials and Gen Z continue to detach themselves from institutional religious affiliation, the impact of the Black church and its leaders is waning further. From the looks of it, many Black pastors don't want to be influential anyway. Just as you can't scroll your timelines without seeing a Black man with a podcast kit calling Black women undesirable and ungrateful, you're also bound to see Black male pastors promoting their most recent sermon, upcoming conference, or revival without taking note of the surrounding misogyny. Their obliviousness is astounding. Unfortunately, many of them get into the act themselves with sermon clips full of religious digs at Black women's relationship choices or ethical commitments. It's 2023 and we're still hearing, "I know you just got your weave done, but you can still give God some praise." And, "Those red bottoms didn't save you," rants from the pulpit. It all raises the question, when will Black men's spiritual awakening take place, and who will lead it? Where are Black male pastors when Black men make a mockery of intimate partner violence? Where are they every time a video or a tweet of a brother belittling a sister goes viral? If pastors can publicly rail at Black women, reminding us that we still need Black men as we accomplish our personal and professional successes, then surely those same pastors can publicly call brothers out when they prove themselves to be men unworthy of being needed. When I was a little girl, I was taught that the most powerful weapon in a Black person's arsenal is a relationship with God. It sustained us when every force in this world sought to kill us. I was also taught that white supremacy's most effective tool is a wedge between Black people. With it, they can keep us divided and never seeing the true value in each other and our collective power. I was reminded of just how painful that division can be when I listened to this sister question if it is possible to remain in community with Black men and be safe. As someone who rolls my eyes every time I check my social media mentions and emails, I get it. As someone who has navigated pain at the hands of Black men in my family and intimate space, I refuse to act like the struggle isn't real. And yet, in our relationship with God that gives me hope, I hold fast to my belief in what Black faith and Black love can do when they intersect. As a follower of Jesus, I know there's nothing he can't do, including soften the hearts of Black men toward the women who have always had their backs. We want to be connected to healthy, whole, and well-adjusted Black men. That will never be too much to ask. As long as Black men dare to declare that God has called them to preach, we should never be without vessels willing to do the dirty work of holding their brethren and them accountable. Now an excerpt from an article published on February 6th in the Religion News Service, written by Emily McFarlane Miller, Lutheran World Federation head Ann Burkhart on historic firsts. Chicago. When the Reverend Ann Burkhart was elected General Secretary of the Lutheran World Foundation in 2021, the Estonian theologian became the first pastor from Central and Eastern Europe to lead the global communion of 148 Lutheran denominations, and the first woman to do so. The first achievement is important because she believes her region has much to teach the wider church about living in the context of persecution and extreme atheism. As for the second, Burkhart said she hopes her work will bear good fruits for the lives of our member churches, particularly for the women in our member churches. The Secretary General spoke to Religion News Service in Chicago, when she was visiting the headquarters of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the largest Lutheran denomination in the country. She also planned to preach at St. Peter's Church in New York and meet with members of the ELCA's advocacy team and key UN stakeholders, including the Ukrainian ambassador to the UN. Burkhardt's U.S. visit follows her first trip as General Secretary to the Holy Land and the Middle East, where she attended the ordination last month of the Reverend Sally Azar, the first Palestinian woman ordained as a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. The General Secretary said she wanted to convey that the worldwide Lutheran communion is really grateful for ELCA's continuous support and for the fact that ELCA hasn't forgotten its sisters and brothers worldwide. A question for her. What were your takeaways from your visit to the Holy Land? What does Azar's historic ordination mean for the wider church? This was indeed a very eye-opening trip for me personally because I not only attended the ordination of Sally Azar, but also visited our LWF World Service Program and Augusta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem, which is serving Palestinian people in a very special way. To have an insight into the realities of where Palestinian people are living these days was very moving, and it made it very clear that we need to strengthen our advocacy efforts. We always say that our task is to give voice to the voiceless, and Palestinians, unfortunately, often tend to be the ones who don't have that strong voice globally. Sally Azar's ordination was, of course, a very special moment, not so only in the life of our member church in the Holy Land, but for the whole region. We hope this will serve as an encouraging example also for other Protestant churches. Knowing that many young Christian Palestinians tend to leave the country, it was also a sign of hope to see that a young person is willing to stay and serve in her home country. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please contact us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-532-8138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.